Right now, it is time for a little monthly segment we do. We put together, compiled a couple of segments, actually. Our district attorney, Hiller Moore, joins us every month. We call it On the Air with Hiller Moore, and he's in now. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good. How are you making out today?
Doing very well. That's a lie. We're all fighting the crud right about now. It's everybody's like powering through a little sickness right now. On the right end of it, though, to be sure. We've got a lot of ground to cover this morning. Can we start with a couple of headlines, though? And sure. We'll get the crime numbers and all that. And as the end of the year approaches, my level of optimism seems to go up. But before we get to the overall crime numbers, got to start with some news items that are out there right now. The headline over WBRZ reads, BRPD searching for teens escaped from the juvenile detention center Tuesday night. They are looking for, right now, 17-year-old David Adkins and 17-year-old Jeremiah Green. What do we know about this? What can we actually talk about this? And can it lead to a bigger conversation about the juvenile detention center?
Sure. So, obviously, this is ongoing right now, and it's very active. So, I'll be careful on what I can say. But surely, it's, again, troubling to see another escape.
Yeah.
It's probably the fifth in 2 years or so. And these are two individuals without getting into their identity, which I did see that it's on the news.
Yeah, it's on the news.
I'll try to avoid the identity. But they are charged with, in district court, in adult court, they're charged with first-degree murder, attempted first-degree murder, as well as armed robbery and, I think, possessions of a weapon. So we're dealing with individuals who have extremely serious charges that have escaped from the juvenile detention and had escaped without anyone's knowledge for like a half hour before they found out. But it still continues to beg the question of the parish prison and the juvenile detention center, which we've talked about for years and really decades.
Yes.
So it's a dangerous place for people to work because you have some dangerous folks that are in there. I think the total beds right now is around 38. And they can't staff fully at 250 because they can't get the people to work there because of the pay is very low. And it's civilians. It's not law enforcement. So it's not trained folks that are armed or, you know, can maybe handle it.
Can we dive into why it's set up that way? I mean, I would feel like it's a detention center. It is.
Yeah.
We're not going to call it a prison, but it shouldn't have some of the same parameters?
Well, I mean, that is one of the issues that we'd have to talk about. But it is, since, you know, the whole thing going back to juvenile. And I think the juvenile system is broken and we should start all over again. And not only Louisiana, but the country.
Okay.
Because the concept, while it's, you know, laudable to be that, it's just kids that we're dealing with, and it's not their fault, the brain's not developed. I understand the science behind it, but still, we're dealing with people, maybe 20 of the 38 are in there for homicide. So we're dealing with a population that's highly dangerous.
Yeah.
And we, you know, deal with folks that you pay $15 an hour to supervise them. So we really need to get this addressed because it's going to continue to happen. Someone's going to get hurt badly.
Yeah. And well, age-wise, these are kids, but these are not little kid crimes. And we've seen, like you said, these two in particular were wanted for first-degree murder, correct?
One was first, okay. And the other one was an attempt.
Okay. Yeah, these are not little kid crimes. So I'm hard-pressed to be convinced as to why we would treat them like children when they're doing grown-up things.
That is a really big debate, and you will find people that disagree with you. And it's something that we have to try to walk the line with. I mean, you can imagine when we have a murder case against a juvenile, say he's 15, and say he's 4'9", mm-hmm. 4'10", but when he has that weapon in his hand, that's an AK that's fully automatic, he's pretty big,
right,
despite his age and size. And when the folks that represent these juvenile defendants, they ask us, would you please let him plead in juvenile court to juvenile life? Well, that means that the maximum he can spend is up to his 21st birthday.
Right.
And can you imagine how that sounds to a parent who lost a child who's also probably a juvenile? They look at you like you have a horn on your head, like, why are you even asking me this? The reality is when you try that person for a jury that's that size and now has a polo shirt on and glasses, and you're asking the jury to put him away for the rest of his life.
Right.
It's a tough, tough deal all the way around.
Well, okay, so the polo shirt and glasses, like, made to look more innocent.
Sure.
Yeah. In fact, this is a perfect example right here. District Attorney Hiller Moore is our guest. We call it On the Air with Hiller. This is a perfect example right here. The two shots, the mug shots, or whatever you would call them, of these two escapees. This kid, Jeremiah Green, I mean, he's 17, but he looks 12. He looks like a little bit wide-eyed kid.
But if you would see, I'm not talking about these two in general.
I'm just saying, to further your example.
If you see them, what they've posted, them, and again, not just these two, in general,
right.
What they post with the weapons and the money and the things they say, what they're talking about doing, you know, that's a, you get a different picture.
Right. And then you're faced with which one's the persona, which one's the real you, and which one's the Jekyll and which one's the Mr. Hyde.
But regardless of whatever happens at the end, it's always they're not old enough, they don't know right from wrong, and their brain hasn't developed, and they had a tough life, which, look, I have to tell you that most of these kids have had very rough lives. Lack of parents.
But is there not room for, okay, no one's disputing that, it's still not an excuse? Yeah.
So the question is, should Louisiana and other states look at increasing juvenile life and increasing supervision over someone that commits these types of crimes and not just have them stay in juvenile detention for 2 years to serve a juvenile life sentence? It's just we're not getting anywhere, and it's getting worse.
And you're not alone in this fight either. We've heard from Tony Clayton
Tony has the worst problem than we do.
Because he doesn't have a place to put him.
Doesn't even have a place to put him.
Right.
So he was sending him to Alabama, which is $400 a day.
Yeah.
So, it's an issue, and I think that probably with the new governor, legislature, I think you're going to see changes in this direction.
Okay. Blank slate. How would you, if we had to tear down the juvenile justice system and rebuild it, how would District Attorney Hiller Moore rebuild it?
Boy, it's a tough question, and it would take a long time. First of all, we'd have to really rebuild the infrastructure of how we handle and discipline and detain these kids. We've done away with all of our bed space and all the training. We just did away with that.
Mm-hmm.
We have to really get that back together. They have to have some real rigid, structured environments to be in to eventually learn from whatever they did.
Okay.
And we have to catch them earlier than what we're catching them now.
Mm-hmm.
When it gets to a murder and armed robbery, it's generally way too late. So that's the biggest part that we have to do. And I think looking at the penalties of what they get and where they would serve them and what type of treatment they would get as a juvenile is important.
Would you get rid of that, quote, juvenile life? I mean,
juvenile life would have to be increased.
Yeah.
We would support a juvenile life, I think. The DA's Association would support a juvenile life increase to give us more authority and more control over this fella. Because at 21, they're just gone. There's no more supervision.
Right.
And so what do you do at that point? And it would help us with the victims' families. And they need some help.
Yeah. District Attorney Hiller Moore is our guest. If I'm reading between the lines a little bit, you said that by the time you're looking at attempted murder, it's already too late. How do you make that? And this is probably the hard part. How do you make that differentiation between kid crimes and grown-up crimes? Because that ramp up to that, nobody is, well, I don't want to say nobody, but by and large, you're not a murderer on day one. There's something you've done smaller than that. And that's where that slippery slope pops in.
So I think that you and I have talked about this before, that overwhelmingly, these kids are not just winding up at your doorstep overnight.
Right.
They are waving their hands saying, I am trouble.
Right.
I'm going to be trouble because of all of this. And I think the biggest indicator is truancy in school attendance.
Mm-hmm.
And we really need to work on that better as a state, but also just Baton Rouge. And you can tell early on. The other, we talked about the Homicide Review Commission or commissions where you look and study, why did someone wind up in this position? We may find out that we've missed some steps along this kid's life. Where did he go wrong?
Right.
How can we fix that hole that he stepped in and got off? To me, those are the ways that you figure that out.
And then you're going to add to that, and again, this is the tough part as well. You're going to add to that with, at what point does the district, the city, parish, the state, at what point do you determine it's a system of crime and punishment and not a system of being a nanny? Like, honestly, the way we're doing it, you could look at the way we're doing it and say, yeah, how's that working out for you?
Yeah.
So we've got to change things. But there's levels that the government isn't built for.
Yeah, so it's somewhat in that vein. We went along with the raise the age to 18, but we warn everyone that if you don't make more room and space for this 1 year, 17, 18, mm-hmm. which is a particularly violent group of people. If you don't make room for them in juvenile detention, you're going to overload detention. You're going to overload the juvenile judges mm-hmm. in the system, and we did not do that. And I believe that you'll see again, beginning in January, a change where that probably will be rolled back, particularly on crimes of violence.
Before we get to break, we got about 2.5 minutes till break. Before we get to break, one more on this particular on the juvenile justice topic, and that is your voice being heard? Is your voice, Tony Clayton's voice, everybody who's speaking out, saying we need more funding, we need more beds, we need more a higher level of employee, are you being heard?
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is yes, but, you know, finding the funds to do those things are the more important part, because everybody is raising their voice all across the state on issues that are important to them.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as a city in a state, we have to get past the crime issue. This should be something that is not, we have to deal with all the time.
Right.
We should have this in place. We don't have it in place. We should be worrying about keeping kids here in Louisiana and getting people promoted in our state, not having people leave. But crime, we just seem to be fighting this all the time, and we shouldn't be.
Okay, not to make this, not to turn this from a local thing to a state thing, but coming up on January 8th, we are going to have a new governor. That new governor is serving right now as the attorney general. He promises in very short order, might have a redistricting session first, but he promises in very short order to hold a special session on criminal justice. How can you take that voice and amplify it to be in front of that special session?
So he has already reached out and made a criminal justice committee.
Mm-hmm.
Tony Clayton is the district attorney's representative on that board. And we, all the elected DAs, provided Tony a list of things that we think are important for the at a state level to look at.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony's presented that list, which it does include juveniles, crime, obviously. And I mean, we're promised that they are going to seriously look at that. And I'm sure that they will. You know, Tony's a good voice to have for us. And I think you're going to see some changes.
District Attorney Hiller Moore is with us. We call it On the Air with Hiller Moore. We're not done by any stretch of the imagination, but we are going to have to pause in about 20 seconds in order to hit news, traffic, and weather. When we come back, let's dive into the Brave Cave. What is the district attorney's role here? I don't know how much we can actually talk about with active investigations and whatnot, especially some involving the FBI. So we will dig in on that. We're also going to run down some crime, overall crime numbers in East Baton Rouge when we come. On the Air with District Attorney Hiller Moore continues right now. We've got the district attorney in the house with us. So we talked about juvenile justice in the last segment. I want to pivot this segment and talk a little bit about the Brave Cave as much as you can.
Okay.
I'm going to go ahead and apologize in advance because when it comes to ongoing investigations, I have no idea what you're allowed to talk about, what you're not allowed to talk about.
Yeah.
So if I ask an out-of-bounds question, just say move on, and we'll move on.
Yeah.
Let's start with this. What is the district attorney's office role in the Brave Cave investigations?
Well, first of all, you know, as you know, several officers have been arrested. So
yes,
those cases will come to us to review and decide whether there's sufficient evidence to prosecute
mm-hmm.
or what we would prosecute for. So that's the first thing. The other is, what about cases that did not involve the arrest of the officers, but maybe involve the officers, and how do I proceed forward with cases that they were involved in? Can I prove my case without an officer who's been at least accused of? And these are guys that are presumed innocent like anyone else. And so it does affect hundreds of cases potentially
mm-hmm.
that I have. And when we're talking about the cases, we're talking about guns and drugs generally cases. So we're talking about serious cases that could potentially be affected. We're trying to look at those. We have to notify defense counsel, obviously, of any case we have that one of these officers are involved in.
Mm-hmm.
And they surely know that as defense lawyers.
Let's expound upon that, the drugs and guns cases, because what we're talking about here is if police officers did wrong in the way they handled violent offenders, drug offenders, it can undo everything those violent offenders did.
Yes, it could, particularly if an officer is found in violation of truthfulness. And
okay.
that kills everything. If you've been untruthful, then you're untruthful, and that's something that really is a killer. At this point, I don't think that there's been any determination of truthfulness or not
mm-hmm.
with this group, but that would be extremely bad if that's the case. But this group of officers were very active and, you know, took a lot of guns off the street. And so
Well, it was the street crimes unit. I mean, they had
their job.
Yeah, very, not to be all movies about it, but a very New Jack City role here is what they were going after. Proven and effective along the way with reducing, but in the short term, but in the long term, I mean, may have done more. Well, I don't know if it's more harm than good. But.
So now that that is disbanded, as you know, the narcotics unit was disbanded and not really fully back again. So two big units that are very much needed mm-hmm. in a city our size that are now kind of gone. So that does affect things on the street. People know when you're gone.
Yes. Yeah, when there's a substitute teacher in the classroom, the kids are going to misbehave.
Absolutely. And so that's an issue. The other is the allegations that everyone was strip searched. I think you've seen that in mm-hmm. some federal lawsuits. There's camera footage of the that location, but only for a month because tapes over itself after a month. So when the allegations were made known, they seized everything. The police department did, and they kept those videos. So that means that there are around 500 hours of video that you have to look to see.
Wow.
So how do you divide that up amongst an officer when you're 100 officers short?
Right.
With the DA. The other is involvement of the FBI for any potential federal civil rights violations or criminal.
Mm-hmm.
What our caution is as a DA, and we've met with the U.S. attorney, the FBI, many times, we don't want to stand in their way. We don't want to do duplicate efforts. Mm-hmm. That is, if there is a witness, you don't want to interview him five times by five different people in five different agencies, which really affects the case. So we would like to rather work together to say, look, this is what we're going to do. Are you okay? Or would you join me in this effort?
So it just as a point of clarification, and District Attorney Hiller Moore is our guest. We call it On the Air with Hiller Moore. Just as a point of clarification, are y'all active in the investigations, or is your role to sit back, let IA handle it, let the FBI handle it, and they'll turn everything over to you?
Mostly in that role.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as things develop, we are meeting with the
sure.
the agencies and discussing with them what they have or what we would like to see them investigate or see if there's something that's there or not. On the other hand, we also have heard from lawyers for the police, and we will continue to hear with them, and we want to know what they want to tell us, just like any other case. We need to know all sides.
I know I'm stepping out of bounds with this one, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is there anything in the investigations, anything in the tea leaves that you're able to not make a prediction on, but see how far down the road this is going to go from a prosecutorial standpoint?
No, I think most of it has been investigated and aired out. You know, we do see some different federal lawsuits that pop up from time to time. And we look at those and the allegations and go from there.
Let me re-ask the question. 13 active investigations right now. Is this going to be where there's smoke, there's fire, and we're going to see a lot more?
I don't see that happening. You would think that by now, Kevin, people that have heard about all this would have come forward. sorry, Kevin.
It's Brian.
anyway.
All good.
But, yes.
Okay, so with all this, is there...
Wasn't Gordy. I didn't say Gordy.
We get District Attorney Hiller Moore in the house. It's a natural reaction, and yeah, I've been called way worse. Is there a way to timeline all of this? Because I feel like there's multiple moving parts here. You've got the firing of the officers. You've got the disbanding of the street crimes unit. You've got a chief of police who's on his way out and a new chief of police about to be on his way in. Is there a sense of urgency, and does that sense of urgency affect the investigation?
So that we do not want to give a date and say we're going to be finished by this date.
Right.
I know the chief wanted to finish before he left. Whether that happens, I'm not sure because I don't know when a new chief will be appointed. But surely that would be more optimal, but that's not going to set when you drop that date. And right now, I know they're finishing up everything. A lot of reports to write. A lot of things to do, a lot of video to look at. So it's ongoing, but it's productive.
We've got District Attorney Hiller Moore with us. There's a story that I want to get to a little bit later on, but I would be remiss if we didn't touch on some of our active crime members right now. We'll pick up Brave Cave at another point because that's the information right there.
Yeah.
That story will continue to evolve and develop as well. Let's talk crime numbers real quick. Where are we at with an EBR?
So we're obviously better than the last for years.
Mm-hmm.
We are currently at 84 homicides, which is, in my opinion, double what we should be.
Okay.
However, at this point in the year, total with the city and the sheriff and other entities, we're down 16% overall on homicides.
Right.
And I want you to, I know our viewers here and listeners cannot see, but the months of August, September, October were very down and low, 2, 4, 5, which is what we would like to see across the board,
mm-hmm.
compared to other months of April and May, 12 and 16. We've never seen numbers like this before.
Down in the single digits.
Yeah, but
for consecutive months.
Correct. 3. And now we're at 5. November has been a little more brutal than we thought, because it was really going down there and it picked up. So we're doing better. Baton Rouge Police is down 21%. The sheriff's office is up 15, but I caution you, they've only had a handful of homicides, 15 total. Normally, that is out of whack for them. Non-fatals, the good news, they're down 28%. Baton Rouge City is down 26%, and the sheriff non-fatals is down 36%. The drug overdoses, unfortunately, remain high. They are 4% higher than last year.
Yeah.
Which still early to predict the end of the year number, but it's okay. Still an issue.
The non-fatals is, and you know I bring this up every single time, the non-fatals is important because when you look at homicides, that number can be down for a number of reasons. Are fewer people being shot, or is the aim just off? And I know that's a crass way to put it, but it's there. Like, if the same number of people are being shot, then we haven't solved a problem.
Correct.
But if both homicides and non-fatals are down, and for that matter, where are shots fired as well, because if they're just completely not hitting the broadside of a barn, then that's another story too. So the non-fatals being down, I think, contributes to the good news.
So I think that's why you see the numbers that are as low. The one other thing that we have to factor in right now is the size of the weapon. So I think we have to look at non-fatals and shots fired,
mm-hmm.
to go along with the murder rate reduction. Mm-hmm. But the type and caliber and dangerousness of the weapon is also something that a doctor can't save someone that's shot multiple times by 223 rounds compared to a 9mm, where you're closer to the hospital, you can get there, you can survive. You can't with that round. So I think to the equation, we have to add that.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
No, it does. Do we have numbers on that?
No, but obviously we know that there are machine guns that are being used. You can hear them on our shot spotters.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know, and we see the machine guns and the switches that we're getting. I'm not sure that we have it down to a number of who was killed by a fully automatic weapon versus the other. It's hard to tell that unless you really actually have the gun and it's a functioning switch or whatever on the weapon. But when you have 90 rounds, you can, at one scene, you can pretty much guess.
I hesitate to even ask it, though, because we see what's in the news. And the homicides and the non-fatals normally make the news. But I live in Sherwood, great neighborhood, but we're within earshot of some not-so-good neighborhoods. And I can hear the gunfire regularly. There's a lot that we don't know about as the public. There's a lot that is not making the headlines. How do we get to the root of that?
I agree. So that's when you're talking about shots fired right now that you hear.
Mm-hmm.
The overall national average is people report shots fired at a rate of 16%. So that's reported by a citizen to police. So that means we miss all of those other shots. So we don't really get a true number. That's why we like the ShotSpotter coverage, because it tells you, but we only have 12 to 14 square miles.
How covered are we?
We're not. Okay. And the coverage that we do have oftentimes is now out of areas that we no longer have an issue with. And
right.
You just don't pick up those devices and move them from pole to pole.
Right.
Expensive.
Okay, it is expensive. So the follow-up was going to be, what would it take to get us there? Let's push pause real quick. We got to check your money now. We got to check traffic. On the Air with Hill or Moore. We'll close it out next. One segment to go with District Attorney Hill or Moore. We call it On the Air with Hiller. District Attorney Moore, got to ask you about, I know we can't get into it too much yet, but there's kind of a growing story on a global level right now. It wasn't that long ago that we pulled out of Afghanistan after a full generation of a war. I think you called 20 years a generation.
Yes.
We pulled out of Afghanistan after a generation of a war. And we're seeing growing number of stories in the wake of that. Most of it has been like from a military perspective, from a what did we leave behind perspective. But there's another story to be told here. And I think it's starting to be told a little bit more on a national, if not international level, about the everyday law and order that we left behind on the streets as well. I don't know how much you could dive in, but what can you tell us about what was left behind in Afghanistan?
It would take us a whole nother show to do this. And it is something that's really critical to me and one that I'm really now involved in. But I'm a member of the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys. Mm-hmm. Mark Dumain, who used to be the CEO of my office in Baton Rouge, now works with that organization as a consultant to them. He's extremely knowledgeable man about international matters. But when we took over Afghanistan militarily and helped them, we started a rule of law. And we trained prosecutors, judges, defense lawyers, investigators as to how to set up a justice system, mm-hmm. like our federal justice system or attorney general system. And we brought them here and trained them. We went there and trained them. And because there was no rule of law before that. It was just Taliban, Sharia law, and it was not good. Women were not allowed anywhere. Women were not allowed in schools, not allowed to be judges, prosecutors. But we changed all of that. And unfortunately, we announced when we left, we announced the date that we were leaving.
Yeah.
And it was close to 9/11, which is even a little more offensive.
Right.
And Taliban knew that we were leaving on that day because we told them we're all at the airport. We're leaving. The planes are taking off. And they tried to do what they could do to get our government workers that were paid by our government directly mm-hmm. out of the country and give them visas to get them somewhere safely because they knew what was going to happen. Well, we didn't do that for prosecutors, judges, defense lawyers.
All the people that we spent 20 years asking to stand up, man
up, prosecute Taliban.
Yeah. Put away criminals, and then in the wake, they are left behind when the criminals regain control.
And we have the video and the pictures of them at the jail with the keys. It's the Taliban at the jail cell, letting former Taliban members out of jail for a host of crimes, war crimes and crimes against women and whatever. Telling them, go seek your revenge. It's the right thing to do. So far, there have been 40 to 50 that have been killed, mainly women, because women were not supposed to be right in that position. We have around 1,500 of them that are at temporary visas in Iran and Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
Not the best places for them to be.
No.
We have been working with Senator Cassidy, has been outstanding, and Gary Graves, of trying to assist us in changing the law and giving these people a particular visa.
Mm-hmm.
We're only talking about a few hundred that we would maybe bring to the country, but we want to get them to a safe country. Right now, they're moving from house to house, and they're being sought after by Taliban all over, and things are desperate right now. And they send out emails every day, all day, to anyone they can reach to say, would you please help me? And here's my credentials, which is dangerous for them to do because those letters sometimes get intercepted. So we are working on that.
This is a story that will continue to grow and we'll be all over it. In the meanwhile, we're straight up out of time for today. He's District Attorney Hiller Moore. Always appreciate the time, sir.
Thank you, Kevin.
We're all done. Moon Grafon's coming up next.